Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
The pageantry of the Santa Monica opening ceremony continues now. About 150 bongo-playing beach dwellers are assembling in a ragged semicircle right before us and setting up their tribal, historic tribal beach bongo beat. And now, a group of about 700 homeless people have gathered, seven being a lucky number. And they're about to set up fireworks, but the police stop them. So that's just some of the grandeur. In fact, that's all of the grandeur of this ceremony celebrating another program in the 25th Le Showiad.
Up in Indiana where the tall corn grows, I do a little thinking about a girl named Rose. Hair blonde as hay and long as a rope. Up in Indiana where the tall corn grows, up in Indiana where the tall corn grows, I do a little thinking about a girl named Rose. Hell don't care, but heaven knows I'm up in Indiana where the tall corn grows. Mama, say a prayer for your only son. God, forgive him all the wrong he's done. All he ever wanted was to have some fun. Now I'm stuck in Indiana till his time is done. I'm up in Indiana where the tall corn grows. I do a little thinking about a girl named Rose. Had blonde as hair and long as a rose. Up in Indiana where the tall corn grows.
Indiana where the tall corn grows.
Indiana, where the tall corn grows.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to the show. Just observing that it's fortunate China didn't have any more pressing uses for $40-50 million than to entertain the world and impress us with how great they are, art, and how they're... we know it's your century, babe. Trying too hard, department. Ladies and gentlemen, at least 17 detainees held at Guantanamo Bay were subjected to a program that moved them repeatedly from cell to cell, purpose to cause sleep deprivation and disorientation, as punishment and as soften them up. Department of Defense Investigations of Abuse had previously revealed the program was used in a limited manner, don't you know, and only on high-value detainees. Hey, that's the name of my band. I wonder if I have to call them and find out if they were... But the documents indicate the program was far more widespread and the technique was still used months after it was banned at Guantanamo Bay in March 2004. Detainees were moved dozens of times in just days and sometimes more than 100 times over a two-week period in a program called the... Tell me they don't have a sense of humor at Gitmo. The Frequent Flyer Program. And that's one where, you know, you're not losing credits over time. Unlike the ones the airlines are running now. Some of the detainees violently objected to the moves, spitting at guards. Oh, come on now. Please, can we have a little decorum at Gitmo? Spitting, really? And resisting handcuffs and shackles after enduring repeated cell transfers, leading to even more sanctions. Detainee 519 Mahar Rafat Al-Kawari was moved six times a day for 12 days in July 2003 with a four-hour interrogation plopped down in the middle of the moves. This is Navy Commander Pauline Storum, a spokeswoman for Guantanamo. There's no such program currently in place. Yes, the adverbs are the weasel words these days. Suspect every adverb. U.S. military investigators deemed the program abusive, but did not describe the extent of its use. The Frequent Flyer Program, ladies and gentlemen. Only those who don't want it enjoy the full benefits of it. Speaking of which... Salim Hamdan, the first person to be subjected to a war crimes trial by the United States since the Nazis, was convicted this week of being a driver for Osama bin Laden. So I just want to warn the guy who drove me to the Craig Ferguson show this week. You are responsible for the laughs I didn't get, sir, and you will be prosecuted therefore. It's clear. That's the way this thing works. By the way, you probably saw the military jurors came back and gave Salim Hamdan all of 6 months for being a driver for Osama bin Laden. I guess because he had GPS. And the question now is, when he serves his 6 months, what will happen to him? The Pentagon refuses to say. The standing policy is that anybody who has been declared an enemy combatant can be held by the United States without charge till the end of the war on terror, or till the moon crashes into Venus, whichever comes first. I'm sure Salim Hamdan can't wait to find that out. Iraq and the United States are near an agreement on all American combat troops leaving Iraq by October 2010. What? That's a timeline. This is the AP saying it. The last soldiers will be out 3 years after that. This is according to two Iraqi officials talking to the Associated Press. U.S. officials say no dates had been agreed to. So there you go. It's a timeline. It's not a timeline. It's a fruit drink. It's a breakfast beverage. It's a hand wash. The proposed agreement calls for Americans to hand over parts of Baghdad's green zone, where the embassy is located, to the Iraqis by the end of 2008. Why, that's this year. That's before the next president takes office. Forget it, boys. It's all been done. It would also remove U.S. forces from Iraqi cities by June 30 next year, according to the two senior officials, both close to Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki and familiar with the negotiations. All combat troops, they said, would be out by October 2010, support personnel gone 3 years later. The schedule could be amended if both sides agree. It's a timeline. It's not a timeline. And which will happen first, ladies and gentlemen? U.S. troops leaving Iraq or one single piece of electronics that can receive both XM and Sirius satellite radio? Now, if you recall what I said a couple of weeks ago when the merger was approved of these two suffering behemoths, they had promised the FCC, as a condition of their original license, that they would produce a radio that could receive both services. Never happened. Now, as a part of the merger, the companies promised that customers wouldn't need new radios. And it was implied, according to CNN, that dual radios, that is, that radios that receive both XM and Sirius would be available soon after the merger. But Mel Karmazin, head of the merged companies, has put the kibosh on that. You'd probably think it would have been nice to have them before the Christmas season, says an analyst. Car companies control the dashboard, says Karmazin. And to make changes, it takes 3 years, unquote. Especially if you're a car company. Especially if they're making cars. In the interim, Sirius XM will introduce a special new a la carte radio that will offer packages that let XM users pick some select Sirius programming and vice versa. I say the troops will be out first, but that's just me. It is just me. And, ladies and gentlemen, because it's clean, cheap, safe, so cheap you can't even meter it, and abundant, let's take a look at nuclear waste and nuclear power. A small amount of plutonium leaked in an aging laboratory outside Vienna run by the International Atomic Energy Agency. They're the watchdogs that make sure everything in the nuclear world is okay. Radioactive contamination was contained to a storage area and no one was injured. Last year, the director warned that the main analytical lab built in 1970 was outmoded and no longer meets UN safety standards. Let's call in some Iranians to investigate, maybe to inspect it. And the planned U.S. nuclear waste dump at Yucca Mountain in Nevada will cost, no, really, billions more than previously estimated due to a hike in the amount of waste it will have to dispose of and inflation. That's according to the Energy Department. Yucca Mountain is expected to cost $96 billion in last year's dollars over its 150-year life cycle, up 67% from the original 2001 estimate of $57 billion. You know, for that much money, we could hold two Olympics in Beijing. The department says it's going to cost, the Energy Department says it's going to cost more than previously expected to dispose of the waste, based on an updated design. Oh, I see. We have to actually get rid of it now. Ward Sproat, director of the Office of Civilian Radioactive Waste Management, says Yucca Mountain is expensive, but it's worth it. It's a lot of money, he says, but I would argue pretty strenuously the cost of doing nothing is a lot higher, Sproat told reporters. He didn't say what he meant. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. It's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. But forget about that. This is from Advertising Age. more advertorial creeps into the news hole. It sounds disgusting, and that's why I'll read it for you. This is me reading it for you now. Mark Haas, CEO of the public relations agency Manning, Selvidge & Lee, had a rather alarming conversation last month with a very senior media planner from an agency outside of his company. Quoting, "I just don't understand what you guys in the PR industry do at the end of the day, because if I need a story for one of my clients, all I need to do is ask a publisher or ad rep, and I get it." That's what Mr. Haas recalled the agency executive saying to him. A recent survey shows that agency executive isn't alone. The recent surveys found that 19% of the 252 chief marketing officers and marketing directors surveyed said their organizations had bought advertising in return for a news story. That represents 1 in 5 senior marketers and is up from 17% last year. Hey, up is good, right? "I'm not saying it's a huge problem," Haas says, "but 19% of senior marketers saying they do it constitutes a problem. That's particularly true in this age of transparency." Quoting Haas again, "One type of coverage you buy and the other you achieve through persuasive argument, making it a credible source of information and not something that has to be taken with a grain of salt. There needs to be credible independent media, and the marketing industry should not be doing anything to undermine credible editorial quality." Unquote. From the It's a Little Late, Babe department. "The backlash that arises from any sort of underhanded scheming can and will spread like wildfire in the digital age. Just ask Walmart and Whole Foods. Walmart was called out for running a pro-Walmart fake blog, and Whole Foods CEO John Mackey was caught posting favorable comments under a pseudonym about his own company. The study reveals that the online world is viewed as a place where marketers can ignore ethical guidelines, and it's that finding that Haas says he finds most disturbing. More than half said marketing industry as a whole is not following ethical guidelines in the new media realm, more than said so a year ago. It's almost like there's a different standard for online activity, and that's a little worrisome because that's the growth area," Haas says. This year's study also found that 8% of respondents, up from 5%, said their organizations paid or provided a gift of value to an editor or producer to place a news story about the company or one of its products. And 10% said their organizations have at one time or another had an implicit nonverbal agreement with a reporter or editor that you expect to see favorable coverage of your product or company in exchange for advertising. Thomas Wang, Ethics and Diversity Fellow at the Poynter Institute, and an editor at the Dallas Morning News, says he finds these numbers incredibly troubling. Quote, "If these numbers are true, it indicates the relationship between marketers and journalists is getting cozier and cozier," he said. "And this could end up making everybody look like the Los Angeles Times." No, he didn't say that. He said, "This could end up damaging the credibility of mainstream news media." We wouldn't want that. Just ask John Edwards. Wang said he has received pitches for stories, including the disclaimer that the subject being pitched had purchased advertising space in the paper. In general, he says newspaper editors are talking more with their ad departments about ideas for new sections that can attract advertising. And sometimes the ad department will come back to an editor and say, "We have a company interested," but at that point the editor needs to make clear there will be no trading of ads for coverage. He says he believes the declining economic situation in the publishing industry could lead editors to make decisions they normally wouldn't. That a significant number of C-level marketers are willing to partake in a pay-for-play model reveals that the concept and value of PR is still very foreign to them. A problem, Haas says, is due to his own industry. Quote, I always thought the PR industry did a poor job of explaining what it does to its advertising and media colleagues, he says. Unquote. They could explain it to me while they're at it. As for the conversation between Haas and a media planner, Haas says he was unable to get a concession that he was right, but he felt he managed to create an aha moment for the executive. Quote, I could see the scales falling from his eyes about the disproportionate value that's created when public relations earns coverage by working with a journalist, he said, compared to what he could get with a check, unquote. I've just had an aha moment as I reach for my checkbook. An epiphany that happened because I read the trades for you, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, the Phoenix lander, no relation to either Phoenix or lander, has found a chemical in the Martian soil that made past or present life there highly unlikely, according to reports on the internet. But NASA officials quickly organized a teleconference this week to announce that although they'd made this unexpected discovery, it has little bearing on whether the planet could or ever did support life. The lander detected perchlorate, a highly oxidizing and potentially toxic compound that's found on Earth in arid regions. The chemical, which is used in solid rocket fuels, airbags, and fireworks, hey Beijing, can harm the human thyroid gland by blocking the absorption of iodine. NASA officials say their consensus view is that the presence of perchlorate probably comes down as a positive rather than a negative in terms of the possibility of life on Mars. It's commonly found in the Atacama Desert of Chile, one of the driest places on Earth. Researchers long believed life could not survive such extreme conditions. More recent studies have found microbes and other organic material living there. NASA often uses the Atacama as an analog for conditions on Mars. They're also studying whether the perchlorate found in the Martian soil could possibly have come from the fuel used to launch Phoenix, although they say the chances of that are very small. So, maybe we should still plan to settle down there. What do you say?
Well, come on, let's go for a trip. That'll be a real gas. Years and maybe give the country some class. It'll be a great ride, and you can't beat the fright. We'll be American guys on Mars. The planet is
Mars.
Mars,
go to Mars, baby, let's go.
There'll be lots of fun.
Mars, go to Mars, hey, let's go.
Please,
Mars,
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show. We haven't talked. I haven't talked. We've never talked. I haven't talked recently about genetically modified foods, partly because the news about that subject seems to have slowed down until this week, after years of legal wrangling over the proper labeling of milk from cows treated with its artificial growth hormone. Monsanto is now proposing to sell that business, specifically the bovine growth hormone given to cows to boost their production of milk. In recent years, Monsanto had been, see if this sounds like a record company, you know, had been suing milk producers who explicitly labeled their product as hormone-free, arguing that was false advertising since all milk has natural hormones. And, you know, natural hormones are just like Monsanto's hormones, except for the thing. And recent studies had argued that recombinant bovine growth hormone delivered global warming benefits. The boosting of milk production meant you could get the same amount of milk from fewer cows, hence less methane. But now Monsanto wants to give up the fight to concentrate on its core genetically modified seed business. Consumers have made it fairly clear they don't want milk from cows treated with the artificial hormone. More than 22% of U.S. cows were on the hormone at one point. As of last year, only 17% still were. And major companies including Kraft, Starbucks, and Walmart announced decisions to sell only milk products from untreated cows. This will, quote, limit our future sales, unquote, Monsanto. Bye. Got milk? And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is struggling still to secure its information technology systems. They have 31 weaknesses carried over from previous years and 13 new weaknesses. Hey, congratulations on the new weaknesses. That's according to a new audit report released by the Homeland Security Department's Inspector General. FEMA corrected 10 weaknesses last year. It developed new policies, processes, and procedures to comply with cybersecurity guidelines. But FEMA continues to suffer from weak controls on employee and contractor passwords, shortcomings in application services development and service continuity, and a weakness in its system-wide documentation, among other problems. These issues collectively limit FEMA's ability to ensure that critical financial and operational data is maintained in a manner to ensure confidentiality, integrity, and availability, the report says. Well, what else is there, really, when you're dealing with documentation? Of course, this is an agency that either admitted or was reported to have very poor ability to track the receipt and distribution of emergency goods. I think that was brought out at a Senate hearing by Senator Mary Landrieu this week. They couldn't figure out who needed emergency stuff and when it had been sent, who'd received it. Aside from that, consequently, says the Inspector General, these weaknesses negatively impacted the internal controls over FEMA financial reporting and its operation. There are 770 former FEMA and contractor employees with some active password privileges. They wouldn't be. Well, I'm sure they're probably gruntled. National Flood Insurance Program workstations deactivations are... Changes to mainframe applications were documented only about half the time. Excessive access privileges are in place on several applications. FEMA's continuity of operations plan has not been updated to reflect concerns raised by... Okay, so somebody understands that stuff. The Inspector General. News of Inspectors General. Ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, the parade of copyrighted features continues with... News from outside the bubble. From the Rupert Murdoch-owned Times of London, Australian scientists have come up with a unique way to combat climate change. Eat kangaroos and save the world. A study claims that farming and consuming more kangaroos instead of cattle and sheep will reduce carbon gas emissions. According to the scientific journal Conservation Letters, the Australian marsupial produces far less methane than sheep and cattle. Methane is one of the worst causes of greenhouse gas. In Australia alone, sheep and cattle produce 11% of the nation's total emissions. Kangaroos, on the other hand, produce relatively small amounts of the gas because they are not ruminants. As with wallabies, the microorganisms in their stomachs differ from those found in sheep and cattle. The study found that increasing the kangaroo population to 175 million and decreasing the number of livestock over the next 12 years would lower Australia's annual greenhouse gas emissions by 3%. One of the researchers said increasing the number of kangaroos that roam the outback, now estimated at over 30 million, to produce the same amount of meat as cattle and sheep by 2020 would also provide substantial conservation benefits. The environment would benefit from reducing the number of hard-hoofed livestock, potentially improving soil conservation, increasing the capacity of vegetation to respond to drought, and improving water quality. Eat more roos. Save planet. Also from the Times of London. New microchipped passports designed to be foolproof against identity theft can be cloned and manipulated in minutes and accepted as genuine by the computer software recommended for use at international airports. Tests for the Times expose security flaws in the microchips introduced to protect against terrorism and organized crime. The flaws also undermine claims that 3,000 blank passports stolen last week were worthless because they could not be forged. Tens of millions of microchip passports have been issued by 45 countries in the belief they will make international travel safer. They contain a tiny radio frequency chip, an antenna attached to the inside back page. A special electronic reader sends out an encrypted signal, and the chip responds by sending back the holder's ID and biometric details. Britain introduced e-passports a couple years ago. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, the United States demanded that other countries adopt biometric passports. Many of the 9/11 bombers had traveled on fake passports. We're not claiming that terrorists are able to fake these passports or fake biometric information in cloned e-passports today, or that they will be able to do it tomorrow, one of the investigators said, but it does raise concerns over security that need to be addressed in a more public and open way. The ability to clone chips leaves travelers vulnerable to identity theft when they surrender their passports at hotels or car rental companies. Criminals in the back office could read the chips and clone them. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of the warm, if you please. Rod? Actually, it's Glenn. Glenn singing Rod. The turbines at Moss Landing Power Plant on the California coast burn through natural gas to pump out more than 1,000 megawatts of electric power. The fumes left over contain at least 30,000 parts per million of CO2, the primary greenhouse gas. Today, this gas wafts up and out of the power plant's enormous smokestacks, but by simply bubbling it through the nearby seawater, a new California-based company says it can use more than 90% of that CO2 to make cement. This according to Scientific American. It's a twist that could make a polluting substance into a way to reduce greenhouse gases. Cement is mostly commonly composed of calcium silicates, requires heating limestone and other ingredients. By burning fossil fuels, it is the third largest source of greenhouse gas pollution in the U.S. Making 1 ton of cement results in the emission of roughly 1 ton of CO2. This new process of making calcium carbonate cement wouldn't eliminate all CO2 emissions. It would reverse that equation. For every ton of cement we make, we are sequestering half a ton of CO2, says a company spokesperson. Pristine temperate forest stores 3 times more carbon than currently estimated by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and 60% more than plantation forests, according to Australian research. Those damn Australians. Again, this is from New Scientist. The finding increases their potential role, not the Australians, the temperate forest role in combating global warming and strengthens the need to protect them, says the lead author. They used remote sensing and direct sampling to study eucalyptus trees at 240 sites across swaths of natural forest in southeast Australia. Plugging the data into a computer, the team calculated that trees in areas untouched by logging store on average 640 tons of carbon per hectare, compared with an estimate for temperate forests of just 217 tons. One reason for the low IPCC figure could be that it is biased towards samples from young forests that have been subjected to land clearing and have since been allowed to regrow. And who would have thought that smog had an upside? It may be the scourge of China's urban citizens and a prickly PR problem during the Olympics, but surprisingly, the pea-soupy fallout from Chinese industrial pollution could be reducing that country's contribution to climate change from at least one greenhouse gas. A British team has been adding sulfate to laboratory rice paddies in an effort to mimic the effect of acid rain on Asia's most important food crop. This equivalent of typical acid rain reduced methane emissions from flooded rice paddies by up to 25%, says Vincent Gauci of the Open University in Milton Keynes, England. Methane from agriculture is the second most important human-made greenhouse gas. By some estimates, up to a third of it comes from methane-generating bacteria in rice paddies. So Asia's thickening smogs could be good news in one respect for the global climate. That's as long as the acid rain does not simultaneously reduce the yield of rice fields, causing farmers to flood more and more fields to maintain production. In fact, says Gauci, the acid rain seems to increase rice yields. That may be how the unexpected methane suppression operates. Now you're sorry about that whole acid rain thing, aren't you? News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Hanging out on the West Coast, trying to find something to do. They don't run on New York time. They roll the sidewalks up at 2. I don't need a big party. I'm just not quite ready to rest my head. I don't want to go to bed.
Not yet, anyway.
Somebody said to go down Fairfax, hang a left, and that's where it's at. They told me,
go to the Cafe Luna,
down Melrose Way.
Go to the Cafe Luna, they're open night and day. Go to the Cafe Luna,
they got a major groove.
Go to the Cafe Luna.
When I walk through the doorway, ow, it's about 2:45. Oh, the scene that I saw in there wasn't what I thought it'd be. Everybody was on the plate with the silverware.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know it wasn't square.
Huh.
I turned to the woman that brought me there and said, what the hell is happening here? She said,
we're at the Cafe Luna.
Yeah.
Down Melrose Way.
We're at the Cafe Luna.
Cafe Luna.
table right out on the street. I'm just partying with my friends. I may be getting something to eat. If you need to find me, assuming I want to be found, maybe
I'm at the Cafe Luna
down Melrose Way.
I'm at the Cafe Luna there open night and day. I'm at the Cafe Luna.
They got a major groove, baby.
I'm at the Cafe Luna.
Some maple syrup, man.
You know, I just happen to have some with me.
You really?
You wouldn't believe it, but I also have
we need some waffles, man.
A pile of nuts. You know what they'd be good on?
Waffles.
They don't have waffles, too, do they?
I think you would probably get them right down at the
cafe. I gotta go. Cafe.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of the man who's just a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney.
Confidential.
Confidential.
Confidential. I'm a big boy. I'm a grown-up. I may be the most grown of the grown-ups. I know in this game, at this level, you win some, you lose some. All the maneuvering, all the muscle, all the rejiggering of the flow chart so everything flows past me. It's all for one purpose. To increase the odds of winning. But it's still a crapshoot. Even though the Secure and Disclosed does boast of a healthy supply of loaded dice. So this week, when my constituent in chief decided, against my better judgment, and his, to take North Korea off the terrorism list, sure, I got mad for a few minutes. Sure, I walked out of a policy meeting and set fire to some files. Anybody would. And sure, I did make a couple of calls to see if I could get Condi Rice put on the TSA's no-fly list. But that was just target practice. Overall, Ms. Rice's batting average against Team Cheney would have had her sent down to the minors faster than an epileptic fastballer if it weren't for the president's lingering fascination with a smart gal who makes him feel smart. You know, the terrorism list had as many holes in it as a telemarketer's do not call list. Throwing North Korea off it didn't stuff a single suicide belt. But for those keeping score, and I am, it was one more reason why I had to turn up my pacemaker to stun. The Pentagon had shot down my plan to paint some American boats in Iranian colors and have them attack us. So I was deep in thought with my post-scooter, Dave Addington. Topic of the thought? Setting the table for our final little war. But it wasn't long before fate handed me a chance to reload the dice. Wednesday, 11:17 a.m.
Now, the Pentagon objected because the false color boats scenario could have gotten Americans killed.
Would have.
Okay. So, what about the same idea, a credible Iranian attack in a non-lethal arena?
What, wrestling?
Stay with me. Cyber attack.
The, quote, Iranians, unquote, unleash a massive attack on our cyber communications. Fortunately,
We've still kept our analog equipment so we can initiate a robust response. I like it. It's clean. We've already given Doug Feith's office a new occupant. Be a piece of cake to get it a new internet protocol address that looks Iranian somehow.
You know, does an attack on our DOD computers pack enough of an oh my god? You know, doesn't the attack have to hit something closer to home?
Well, what's closer to home than the Pentagon? I spend half my days there.
I mean closer to other people's home.
Shut down the credit card computers?
I think the economy's a little too delicate for that.
For a day?
For half a day.
Mm.
What if we blind our own Homeland Security communications for a day or two?
Unfortunately, Dave, from the briefings I've gotten, wouldn't make a heck of a lot of difference.
No, I know. I've gotten those briefings, too, but nobody else has. It might still have some serious scare potential.
Scare potential, yes. Productive panic potential, doubtful. But, you know, that's just me.
All right. What about civilian communications links? Let's say some Iranian hackers are able to knock out our satellite and fiber links during the Olympics. You think Americans wouldn't be pissed about that?
You know, if we do it during gymnastics, we get the biggest pro-war spike among women since Khrushchev banged his shoe at the UN. As I recall, the survey info, the gals felt bad for the shoe. But
sir, this is Secure Undisclosed Security. Senator McCain is here to see you.
Dave, you want to make yourself scarce?
Oh, you bet. I'll go mess with Dr. Rice's cable traffic.
Okay, security. Send in the senator. Something about John McCain always got stuck in the secure undisclosed craw. Maybe it was just the way he always seemed to project an attitude of his priorities during the Vietnam War being better than my priorities, which of course were other. And yet when Team Bush hit him good and hard in the 2000 South Carolina primary, he crumpled like a diabetic in the Powder Puff Derby. Now we lent his campaign three of our hardest punchers, and he was reciprocating by putting out the not-welcome mat for yours truly at the upcoming convention. Something didn't add up, so I'd invited John over for a little remedial math. Wednesday, 11:27 a.m.
Well, you should have seen this ad. We didn't use. Our guys had rigged up some footage where it looked like Obama was in Paris Hilton's sex tape.
Yeah, love to see that if you can get a message to Steve.
Oh, sure. Then, of course, I'd do that joke about entering Cindy in a topless beauty contest and all hell breaks loose. We'd have been better off running the sex tape ad. Ads, at least, I can deny knowledge of.
John, I'd love to sit here and listen to you waste my time all day. Unfortunately, I've got a world to manage. So what's this I'm hearing about the convention schedule not having room for the sitting vice president of the same party? If I were a little less in control of my feelings, I might be tempted to take that as a personal snub. Be ashamed to have to do that.
Oh, Dick, my friend, we've known each other for quite a few years. We're both grown-ups. We both know the score. We're neither of us amateurs. We've both been at this for a while.
Jesus, I hope there's a pony in there somewhere.
There is. Here's the pony, my friend. Your approval rating is closer to zero than to any other number with a zero in it. I'd lose fewer votes if I had a rapper speak at my convention, and his security detail would be less disruptive. What do you need to appear at my convention for? You're achieving your goals. Greater executive power, the projection of American power throughout the Middle East, a firm commitment to petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
What's one speech going to add to that, my friend?
John, there's a significant part of the Republican base that just doesn't want to see Dick Cheney humiliated. You may not be aware of that because you don't seem all that at home with the Republican base. These are tough cookies, sir. If they turn against you, they could spend the next 4 years trying to prove that you killed Vince Foster. I wouldn't mess with him.
Dick, my friend, this is far too trivial a matter to start dealing in threats.
John, my friend, nothing's too trivial. You'll learn that if you happen to win this election. But threats aren't really necessary when I can just grab both your arms.
No, they can't be reached.
Hurts me just to do this to you.
So look, John.
Yeah.
You've already got my constituent in chief speaking on Monday night.
The president?
Bingo.
Yeah.
So, why not schedule me right before him? If any negative is going to rub off of me, it'll rub right off on him.
Yeah.
By the time you arrive Thursday night, we'll both be distant memories.
Oof.
Like your arms.
Dick, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't necessary.
Well, let's just say we have a difference of opinion about that. So, what do you say, war hero?
All right. Okay. Okay.
Well, thanks for stopping by, John. Oh, you'll find ice bags at the security desk. And, by the way, it goes without saying, but...
But what?
I'm not your friend. I'll get the door. John may not know it right now, but I'm in a very charitable mood towards him. I'm not even going to regard his sudden change of mind as a flip-flop. As for Condi, she'd better start drafting her explanation for why we're not retaliating against a country that's hijacked our Olympics. And I don't like her odds. End of partial diary for mid-August 2008. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential.
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 And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Salim Hamdan, the convicted driver of Osama bin Laden, thanked his jurors for his sentence and repeated his apology for having served bin Laden. Quote, I would like to apologize one more time to all the members and the jury, and I would like to thank you for what you've done for me, he said. The H&M clothing chain has apologized in Vancouver over a breastfeeding brouhaha, saying it regrets any embarrassment or concern for the mother who was asked by staff to nurse her baby in a change room. That's change you can't believe in. Senator John Edwards, of course, has apologized for the lying and the thing. Four U.S. cyclists who wore masks over their noses and mouths over pollution fears when arriving in Beijing apologized to Olympic organizers. They apologized to the U.S. Olympic Committee, which had given them masks in the first place. Circuit City stores temporarily banned Mad Magazine from its store shelves for poking fun at Circuit City. The Richmond-based company said this week some overly sensitive souls had the issue removed, and we apologize for the knee-jerk reaction. Chinese police apologize for roughing up two Japanese journalists 3 days before the games open. The London Evening Standard apologized to the Duke of Edinburgh after publishing a story falsely alleging he was suffering from prostate cancer. The FBI Director Robert Mueller apologized to the editors of the New York Times and the Washington Post for what he said was a recently uncovered breach of their reporters' phone records in the course of a national security investigation nearly 4 years ago. Senator John McCain's presidential campaign has apologized for an incident that denied access to a black reporter at a press briefing. And a celebrity chef in England has apologized after he recommended the use of a poisonous plant in recipes. He had recommended henbane. He had meant to recommend fat hen, which is a wild herb. Watch your hens, babe. That's going to conclude this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on the newly merged XM Sirius satellite radio, available
via the internet at two different locations whenever you want it, live and archived, harryshear.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/theshow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. Mid out the music. And it would be just like having the music on the podcast. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. A ridiculously premature farewell to the great Hiram Bullock. The email address for this broadcast and playlists from this show are available, as well as incredibly important information about upcoming personal appearances, like in Seattle at Jazz Alley, at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.